Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Living first as a man and then as a woman is not something that many people choose to do. She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders, is the name of a book and the story of a man who became a woman by Jennifer Finney Boylan. For as long as he could remember, James Boylan felt he was in the wrong body, spending his childhood years playing Girl Planet, where the air turned anyone who breathed it into a girl, and his adolescent and young adult years dressing up in women's clothing, James was convinced that the only thing that could save him was the love of the right woman. When he fell in love and got married, he threw out the women's clothes and pledged his life to manhood. But being a loving husband, a responsible father, and a respected professor, and an acclaimed writer, couldn't stop this feeling that he had that he was, despite evidence to the contrary, a woman. And so, with the unfailing support of his family, friends, and several doctors, James became Jenny. Jennifer Finney Boylan is the co-chair of the English department and a professor of English at Colby College in rural Maine. I spoke with her by phone from her home in Maine and asked her to begin by telling us about the internal force that motivates her to be the person she has become and make the changes she has made along the way.
Being transgender is many things. It is a psychological condition, but it's also a medical one. Its genesis is found in utero. It is believed to be a result of brain structure in the hypothalamus. So it's something that comes from a physical start and yet manifests itself over the course of a lifetime in all sorts of different ways.
Well, tell us how it manifested in your life.
Well, I had a sense that I was female from a very early age, from as young as 3. And I choose my words carefully there, that when I say it's a sense of being female, what it's not is about being feminine. And I think that's a commonly misunderstood thing.
Can you distinguish that for us?
Yeah, sure. It's not about affect. It's not about how you want to dress or how you want to look. I think people wrongly think of transgendered people, or transsexuals in particular, as drag queens or as very, you know, effeminate men. And that's not the case at all. If you think about women, for instance, and I think all women do this, we find for ourselves the place along the spectrum of gender where we feel at home, whether that's Dolly Parton at one end or, I don't know, Janet Reno on the other. And each woman finds herself on that scale and sometimes changes along that scale over the course of a lifetime. All of these people are women. That is the thing that transgendered women face as well. So it is about being female. It's about feeling at peace in a body, and it's a connection between a brain and a body. And again, the brain has a particularly female structure in the hypothalamus that men don't have, and it has nothing to do with being gay or straight. It has nothing to do with who you're attracted to. It has to do with who you are. In its truest sense, I guess it has to do with soul, with spirit.
How would you describe the female structure in the hypothalamus?
I'm an English teacher, man. I've read the report, and I'm going to get in way over my head, but the research is pretty clear that it's a part of the hypothalamus that is larger in men than in women. It's not something that grows as a result of hormones. It's not something that there's any correlation between sexual orientation. It's about how you think, how you feel about yourself.
You were describing realizations you had when you were a very young child, about 3.
One day, my mother was ironing one of my father's shirts, and she said to me, "When you grow up, you'll wear shirts like this." And I thought, why would I wear shirts like my father's? That's the earliest memory that I have, my earliest memory also of being confused about gender. And from that time onward, it was my sense that I was in the wrong body. And I also knew, as most transsexuals do, that this is something I better keep to myself. This is something that if I share this with other people, they will find curious, impossible, and hilarious.
As you grew up through puberty and adolescence, you began to share these concepts with other people. How was that?
I didn't speak to a soul about this until, I guess it was a year after college, I got therapy for the first time. As I got older, even, you know, when I was from, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15, as you get more sophisticated about the difference between male and female, the degree of trouble that I was in became more profound to me. You know, when you're 3, you know intuitively, oh, I should be a girl, even though if you were to ask what's the difference between a boy and a girl to a 3-year-old, they might not even be able to tell you. But you know enough to know that you're in the wrong place.
You use the term degree of trouble. What do you mean by that?
Well, it means being in conflict. It means being in conflict with yourself. It means being in conflict with your parents. And it means being in conflict with the world. That you believe something to be true, which everyone else believes to be untrue. And if your knowledge were shared, it would hurt the people that you love the most.
So that required a fairly involved reconciliation, both personally in your mind and physically in your body over the years.
It involves living your life like a spy. At every moment, while you think on the tip of your tongue, you know, I'm really a girl, it means acting like a boy and making sure no one ever guesses, and that in fact you would go to extremes to keep people from guessing your secret. In fact, I was thinking the other day that if I were in a town now where Jennifer Finney Boylan was coming to read from her new memoir, if it was the old me before I was out, I wouldn't have gone, because I wouldn't have wanted people to think, well, why is this person going to this reading? And a very frustrating thing was that when I finally came out and shared the secret with people, I'd kept the secret so well that people did not believe me. They thought that I'd lost my mind and that they said, this can't be true. In a sense, what they were telling me was that they knew me better than I knew myself.
Well, often we hear that in life.
Yeah.
Often people will say, this is the way you are, which creates molds and boundaries. But what I'm wondering, Jenny, is, what was the final straw, or some of the straws that led up to you coming out?
I guess an important part of the story is that I did fall in love, and I had always believed, as many transgendered people do, actually as many straight people do, that whatever is wrong with me will be cured by love, that in falling in love with another, I will get outside of myself, I'll escape myself. I'd believed that from a very early age, and in fact, my prayer was answered in my late 20s when I fell in love with the woman who I would marry, Grace, and we had a terrific, wonderful relationship. But I didn't share my secret with her because I had hoped that by that time my prayer was answered and that I was cured. And if that sounds crazy, all I can say is that it's actually very typical of transgendered people. It's what you do. You pray to have this burden lifted, and then when love comes along, for a little while anyway, it can lift that burden. But by the time I was 5-6 years into my marriage, I knew that I was going to have to share this with the woman I loved, and that made it even worse in some ways, because it was bad enough that I was transgendered, but even worse, I kept a secret from the person that I loved. So I guess one of the first things that happened was having the conversation with Grace, saying, I've got a secret.
Can you tell us about that?
I went on a long walk, and I just felt like I was being crushed. And you know, we believe, you know, we hear again and again in the culture the mantra, the truth is better than lies, and the truth will set us free. In many ways, I felt that by keeping my mouth shut, I was helping to protect my family. We had 2 children by that time. I felt that I was doing the right thing by keeping the secret. And yet, at a certain point, I couldn't carry that burden alone any longer. And you know what it's like? There's not a single day when suddenly, you know, the clouds part and the sun shines. What it is, if you can imagine every day carrying like a Santa Claus sack on your back and putting a pebble in, 1 pebble each day. By the time I got to be 40, that sack was very heavy, and there was simply one day I just could not lift it to my back another day. Why that day? I don't know. So I came out to the woman that I loved, and we tried finding a middle ground with it for a while, but in the end it was clear that the only thing for me was therapy, and therapy led to the course of transition.
I'd like to take a moment and say that we're talking with Jennifer Finney Boylan. She's the author of She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders. It's a story about the change from James Finney Boylan to Jennifer Finney Boylan, personally and physically. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jenny, what was the adjustment like for your family and for your children?
Well, it was hard, of course, but I would say that we were careful. We tried to work this together as a family, and while this has not made the lives of the people that I love any easier, to say the least, I will also say that there are worse things that can happen to a family. And once it was clear that this was something that just had to happen and was going to happen, the other question was how to deal with it together as a family. And since we did do this carefully, and since my partner Grace is a social worker, we were able to ensure that the effect on my family was as benign as possible. We worked carefully with their schools, with their teachers, with their friends, with their friends' parents. And in the end, again, I found that people are and were generally loving. When you go to them with a sense of needing someone's unconditional love and their understanding, people generally will reach for their best selves if you give them the chance. And in the case of my own children, they were remarkably resilient. What we needed them to know was that, first of all, they didn't cause this, and that I wasn't going away, that I was still the same person, and that I still loved them. And as a result, they were, you know, their sense was, well, as long as you're still you. I mean, the way we explained it was that sometimes people feel differently on the inside than on the outside, and that I have this particular condition that makes me feel like a girl on the inside, and my outsides don't match that, so that I took medicine that enabled me to be a whole person and that enabled me to be happy. And my children were, I hate to say, but they are generally unfazed. And I say that knowing full well that this is an issue which will continue to reverberate throughout their lives.
How old are your children now?
They're 7 and 9.
And how long ago did you have the surgery?
Surgery, which I'll quickly add is not the most important part of the process, happened about 1.5 years ago. I mean, I think we tend to fixate on the surgery because it's the most sensational and lurid part of the process. But, you know, it's kind of like the surgery is to this kind of like going to court is in a divorce. I mean, it's kind of the official part. It's the last thing that makes it all complete. The important stuff and the hard stuff is what goes on before that.
Well, there's a section of your book that I'd like you to read that kind of talks about how you shared this story with your children. Could you do that for us?
I'd be glad to. One day, Luke said, "We need to come up with a better name for you than Daddy if you're going to be a girl." "Okay," I said, "well, what name do you think would work? You know, I use the name Jenny when I'm a girl." "Jenny," Luke said, bursting into laughter, "that sounds like the name of a little old lady." Trying not to be hurt, I said, "Well, okay, well, what else can you think of?" Luke thought about it for a moment, then he said, "Well, how about Maddie? You know, like half mommy, half daddy." I just sat there amazed at the versatility and ingeniousness of children. Patrick, at this point, chimed in, "Or Dommy." The name Dommy made them all laugh some more, and I said, "Okay, you can call me Maddie if you want to." They started calling me Maddie then and there, and within a month or two had changed pronouns as well. I shifted genders so slowly and so gently around my children that when I finally appeared before them for the first time wearing a skirt and makeup, they hardly noticed the difference. On this occasion, I had spent the day at the lake working, then went down to Freeport Studio to do some shopping. I came home late in the afternoon to find that the babysitter, who'd already been briefed on the situation, already had them in the tub. I walked into the bathroom to say hi to my children, and Luke looked up at me and he said, "Hey." And I said, "Hey, what?" And he said, "You're not wearing your glasses." I said, "Hi, Patty," waiting for him to give me his reaction. "Maddie," said Patrick, annoyed. He was holding a little plastic submarine. "What?" I said. "We're trying to play a game here?" "Oh," I said. "Sorry."
Jenny, was the transition with other members of your family so gentle?
Yes and no. My mother had a hard time. I think in some ways, the only thing harder than the question, what would you do if you had this condition, is what would you do if it were your own child? And my mother is a buoyant optimist, and she struggled for a while. She thought that she could solve this all herself somehow. But in the end, in fact, not in the end, the very first day when I told her about this, she did say, well, love will prevail. And she said, I'll never turn my back on my child. And that's generally been her impression. She has stayed by me.
You've spent a lot of time recently traveling around the country talking about your book and sharing your story. What are your observations on the reactions of the people who you see?
There are a couple things. Most importantly, this is not a story that is for people who want to have a sex change, particularly. This is a story for people who are trying to find the courage to live an authentic life, whatever that might mean for themselves. This story has been told before. There are plenty of memoirs of transgendered people out there. My hope was to tell a story that acknowledges the difficulty of this for the person going through it, for the people that love that person, but a story that would also connect to people who've never heard of this before, people who've always thought of transgendered people as just wingnuts. This is a story that I hope people will realize, that what we all have in common is a lot more important than the things that separate us. This is in many ways a very familiar story to a lot of people. Also, a thing I've noticed on the road is that people seem much more sophisticated about gender issues and about transsexuality in particular than I had expected. That I'm not the first transgendered person most people have met. Everyone, although people still don't know about it in the same way they know about gay and lesbian people, they've seen shows on television, or they've read a book, or they've seen a documentary or something. So maybe our country has become a little more sophisticated. I like to think that's true.
The writer Richard Russo has an afterword in your book. You and he are colleagues and co-professors of English. Can you comment on the nature of your friendship with him?
Yeah, well, actually, the joke that I tell is that 7 years ago, Russo and I were sitting around in our little office at Colby College, and one afternoon we said, okay, I tell you what, 6 years from now, one of us will become a woman, and the other will win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. So we flipped a coin, and he lost. Ha, ha, ha. but the reason Russo is in the book is because I wanted to trace the course of a very male friendship, which Rick and I had. We're very close friends, and you know, his closest friend turning into a woman was not his idea of the best way to improve the friendship. And in many ways, the friendship is more guarded now, in a way that men and women's friendships are a little more guarded.
How would you describe that?
Well, I think in some ways we choose our friends sometimes based on the effortlessness and ease with which we kind of fit into each other's lives. And often, not always, but often men find it easier to relate to other men because other men's lives are often similar to the lives that men are living. I think women seem mysterious to men. And so it's a little harder to...
But with the history and the current circumstances, that's why I ask.
Yeah, I mean, and because in many ways, in all the important ways, I am the same person, and yet gender does matter. And so Rick is, I think, a little bit less likely to tell me something that might hurt my feelings, for instance. Whereas in the old day, he'd just think, well, Boylan can take it. I think he chooses his words a little more carefully around me. I think he's a little bit more gentle around me, which is not necessarily a good thing.
Jenny, as you made the transference from male to female, sometimes you were a man, sometimes you were a woman. What was that like? What are some of the events that come to mind?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a very strange time. I called it boy-girl. That was my shorthand for it, that I was in this place where I could literally go from male to female based on a few very small nuances, like whether my hair was loose or tied back or whether I was wearing earrings or not. And during that time, I set about kind of testing the waters of womanhood and taking notes on what this new world I was joining was like. And one of the things I did during that time was I went shopping for a car. As a guy, I remember the test drive I took involved driving really fast and cranking up the Dave Matthews Band on the stereo and talking about the platinum-tipped spark plugs of this this car I was test driving. When I went back as a woman, they talked about how safe the car was, and they showed me the cup holders and the vanity mirrors. And we certainly didn't go on any fast, crazy test drive or turn on the radio. I guess the punchline of that, which everyone else could have predicted except for me, was that as a man, they offered me the same car, the exact same car, for $1,000 less than they had when I came as a guy.
Did you ever call them on it?
I never did. I should have, but the time of being between genders really didn't last all that long, and eventually the world of men kind of faded behind me.
In the way you structured the book, going from the past to the present, the juxtaposition of timing.
Right.
What was your thought of that as in the literary style?
Actually, you know what's funny? As someone said I was channeling Vonnegut. I didn't really think that I was playing around that much. I mean, the beginning of the book was hard to do because, and in fact, the beginning of the book was one of the last chapters written. It was important for me that people see the narrator of this book as a woman from the get-go. And so that's why I start out with a chapter that is this kind of crazy adventure that I had, but that it starts out with the fact of my womanhood not in dispute, and that I'm perceived, I'm seen by others as female there. So it's only after that chapter, and also that chapter, you know, that chapter establishes Rousseau, it establishes the past, it establishes a number of the kind of crazy things that I've gotten to see because I've lived in two genders. But only after that chapter do I go back in time and start from the beginning. And from there on, the book travels a pretty straight line, with the exception of the surgery chapter. And I wanted the surgery chapter to... I did not want to focus on, again, the kind of salacious medical business, because that's been done. In a way, I wanted to celebrate that transformation as a kind of very American moment. And it's funny, no, there haven't been any reviewers that have really picked up on this. I wanted to say that in going through this transformation, this act of self-invention, it's a very American thing to have done, although obviously this is something that happens to people the world over, and people have surgery the world over. But everything in that chapter, all those little weird blurbs, have to do with aspects of patriotism in a way. It's my mother and I visit Abe Lincoln. I remember a 4th of July as a child. I remember sitting on a beach at the Bicentennial watching fireworks. And all of this is juxtaposed between the process of actually going through the surgery.
Well, Jennifer Finney Boylan, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Oh, Barry, thank you so much for having me. It meant a lot to me.
And before we close, Jenny, can you tell us about an interesting book that you would recommend?
Well, I guess to me... for all of its faults, I always come back to The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, particularly for someone who is trying to find the courage to do something that would seem to go against the law of the contemporary culture. I always love that scene in Huck Finn where Huck, who's been essentially breaking the largest law of the era, he's helping to free a runaway slave, thinks that what he ought to do is follow the law and do what's right. And what's right by the law of that era is turning his dear friend Jim into the police. But he writes out a letter to Miss Watson, who owns Jim, and he wants to send this letter. But as he looks at the letter, he starts to remember how dear Jim is to him. And he thinks, it was a close place. I took up the letter and I held it in my hand. I was trembling because I had to decide forever between two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then I said to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said, and I let them stay said, and I never thought no more about reforming. I shoved the whole thing out of my head, and I said I would take up wickedness again, which was in my line, being brung up to it, and the other weren't. And for a start, I would go to work and steal Jim out of slavery. And if I could think up anything worse, I would do that. Because as long as I was in and in for good, I might as well go the whole hog.
The story of Huckleberry Finn speaks for Jennifer Finney Boylan in some ways.
Well, I think it speaks for a lot of people. Sometimes in order to do the right thing, you have to do what appears in everyone else's minds to be the wrong thing.
Jennifer Finney Boylan, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Boylan is the author of She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders. The book that she recommends is Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.